So now I'm going to turn to the San Francisco Chronicle of July 17, 2025, kind of a back page, A5. The headline is Proposal Would Spread Out City Shelters by Aldo Toledo. And generally what I'm going to comment on, and I guess maybe that's more important than the actual text of this story, but I'm going to read a bit of it so you can hear the specifics. San Francisco is continuing to claim it is providing new shelter under the new mayor, Daniel Lurie, fusion with Supervisor Bilal Mahmoud, which shelters are pretty shitty, generally speaking. The real issue is housing, and until that happens, leaving homeless people alone to do what they need to do and providing them services where they're at in place, sheltering in place, as was the phrase during the COVID hysteria. But as I was reading to you in the previous article, the destruction of the basic right to be cruel, be free from cruel and unusual punishment, has been eliminated by the Supreme Court, or should we say, doused for the time being, although there is still this lawsuit going on, as I also read to you from the street sheet in San Francisco, demanding that the police stop seizing homeless property and, I guess, compensate them for what property it has already stolen and taken. I think the main point may be to get an injunction, or at least I think that's the object lesson for those of us who are observing police raids down here in Santa Cruz. This attempt to claim you're actually moving people into better conditions, and that's why people are being faced with these increased sweeps in all these other cities, including Santa Cruz, but this story is about San Francisco, is masked nicely, as usual, with exaggerated or misleading claims about the existence of shelter or the sufficiency of shelter, or the real problem being not shelter, but the unwillingness of homeless people to accept shelter because they're shelter resistant or mentally ill or want to do their drugs or so forth. Not that some of these conditions aren't sometimes true, but the reality generally is the notion that there is a new normal that says people have got to be put into crappy conditions that would not have met minimal standards in 1979, but now have to do it because people in much better middle-class circumstances and upper-class circumstances just don't want to see them on the streets, is outrageous, as far as I'm concerned, and basic violation of human rights, and really violates such basic things as the right to sleep, which is what I have pressed to restore in Santa Cruz for many decades. Anyway, here's this story by Aldo Toledo, Proposal Would Spread Out City Shelters. For years, San Francisco's approach to fighting homelessness has concentrated shelters and services in just a handful of troubled neighborhoods. Now, city leaders are considering legislation that would effectively impose a moratorium on new services and shelters in areas such as the South of Market and the Tenderloin, while establishing a new data-driven system that ties shelter capacity to neighborhood needs. Here's my cynical comment. In other words, they don't want the services and shelters where they're most needed, where homeless folks are currently clustering in those lower-income neighborhoods. They want to put them elsewhere in order to remove the pressure on the police department, because the police department is choosing to get themselves in situations where that pressure happens. They're invading people's domiciles, the domiciles being the tents and the places they are in the streets. So it's another attempt to beautify without providing real, effective, and useful services to people. You might say, well, they're trying to be equal because they want these shelters to go into neighborhoods that otherwise might be uppity about having those kind of people in there on their streets, and that might be a healthy thing for them to have more people on their streets. But the real question is that actually going to work? And or will there be pushback against by the new neighborhoods in San Francisco, so actually they'll end up being less shelter? I wonder about that. Continuing the story, Supervisor Bilal Mahmoud told the Chronicle that he has made significant changes to legislation he introduced in April, which requires the city to approve at least one homeless shelter or behavioral health site in every district over the next 18 months and prohibit new sites within 1,000 feet of existing ones. So if you have a concentration of people but you're not going to serve them, why not put something that is miles away from them and claim you're being fair? That's one way of trying to depopulate the area, hoping that they'll go to those places and risk the hostility of the new neighborhoods. Continuing, the changes are the result of negotiations between Mahmoud and Mayor Daniel Lurie, who in April expressed support for a, quote, data-driven strategy. And these, of course, are the phrases that are always nicely used to justify cruel and ineffectual behavior that's really another word for get them out of sight and out of town. Data-driven strategy to fight homelessness, but did not outright support the legislation back in April. So Lurie wouldn't support it initially. Now it appears Mahmoud successfully convinced the mayor, and should he retain the support of six of his colleagues, supervisors, who signed on to the original proposal, the bill is likely to pass. Mahmoud introduced the revised legislation at the board's Budget and Finance Committee on Wednesday. So all you San Francisco friends of homeless people, get your asses up there and start raising your voices about this issue. Among the changes, Mahmoud said he is lowering the shelter buffer zone from 1,000 feet to 300 feet. In other words, it's going to be, you have to be 300 feet away at least, not just 1,000 feet away, but 300 feet away. Actually, that doesn't make much sense, so I'm going to skip this one because it's actually less. So it would reduce clustering of homeless and behavioral health services. Seems to me that if your buffer zone is less, you're going to have more clustering, but what do I know? He pointed to city data that says the Tenderloin has about 18% of the city's 8,300 unsheltered people as of the last point in time count, but holds 33%, that's compared with 18% of the population of the unsheltered people, you get 33% of the city's 3,200 shelter beds. Notice the 3,200 shelter beds does not obviously address 8,300 unsheltered people, and the unsheltered estimate is probably a real undercount, I would suggest, illustrating the imbalance, and that's based upon the kind of anecdotal stuff I hear in Santa Cruz rather than any solid scientific analysis. So there's a reluctant admission from me. So you should get your own data on this. The revised legislation would establish a needs-based shelter model. Nah, it's the money-based shelter model, and they're only doing a limited number. And in the meantime, the money is going to the police to clear away people's own homemade DIY shelter of tents on the street. So that's the real objective. Similar in a way to what the Israeli government is doing to the Palestinians, driving them out for the benefit of the well-to-do who are there. The revised legislation would establish a needs-based shelter model that would prioritize funding for new shelters in neighborhoods where there are more unsheltered people than places to house them, and require that decisions on future shelters be made based on the numbers. Nah, not really. There's all over the city, there are insufficient shelters for the people, including the Tenderloin area that they're concerned about. But they want to depopulate the Tenderloin area. So this, of course, gives justification now. So when the police show up doing their ICE-type activities, and I don't know if how San Francisco police are proceeding there in terms of probably not quite as bad as ICE. After all, homeless people are, they're black folks as well as white folks there, and they're of course, they're what we'd call the new slaves, or as the Southerners would say, the new niggers. So they can be treated any way the city wants them to be treated without people being that concerned, or at least being able to write it off as, oh, these folks are mentally ill, these folks are alcoholics, these folks are drunk, these folks are service resistant, these folks are ne'er-do-wells, these folks are bums, the usual stuff. The city would only approve new shelters in oversaturated areas like his district via a board of supervisors vote. So if you want to get something in the Tenderloin, you got to get a specific vote to do it now if this new legislation passes. Mahmoud's original bill required a shelter be built in each district, but he said he received a commitment from Mayor Lurie that money set aside for building shelter beds over the next 3 years will be spent outside neighborhoods like the Tenderloin and Soma. The legislation would update every 2 years using new data from the biennial point-in-time count, the single-day survey of all unhoused people within city limits. Just kind of a joke in Santa Cruz, but I haven't got any specific reports from San Francisco. It also exempts shelter expansions at existing sites or relocation of services within a neighborhood. That would mean if there's more need, real need, in a neighborhood because they have more homeless people, you can't expand the shelter at the existing sites or relocate the services in some way to make that better within a neighborhood. You've got to get them away and out of the neighborhood. What Mahmoud then says is, what we're trying to address is twofold. How do we respond to homelessness citywide, not just with a patchwork of independent decisions? And how do we avoid repeating the mistakes of the past by oversaturating certain neighborhoods, Mahmoud said. Well, you might begin by imposing some meaningful rent control, by, I don't know, some heavy taxes on wealthy corporations and businesses, and then actually appropriating money for housing, not necessarily building new housing, but taking over existing housing that's being used for profiteering purposes. There are all kinds of things that could really be done if there was a serious interest in addressing homelessness, but is not being done. A chronicle analysis and map of shelter capacity in San Francisco showed the majority of shelters are located on the city's less affluent east side, with no services at all west of Twin Peaks. There is only one shelter with a 35-person capacity west of Masonic Avenue in the Richmond District. But notice there are no figures that are being given in this story, this is my comment, about how many people are actually in the area west of Masonic Avenue in the Richmond District that might be using these imaginary or proposed shelters, and the excuse for not building more shelters where they're needed. Lurie told the Chronicle in a statement Tuesday that he is working relentlessly to tackle the twin crises of homelessness and behavioral health on San Francisco's streets. The mayor had previously suggested amendments that would have gutted Mahmoud's legislation. Quote, "We have worked productively with the Board of Supervisors," Mahmoud is the supervisor, "on significant legislation to help the city do that work, from fentanyl state of emergency ordinance to the budget that will unlock tens of millions of dollars to help people on the streets get on the path to long-term stability," Lurie said. "Thanks to this partnership with Supervisor Mahmoud, we will continue that work with urgency while ensuring that every neighborhood gets to be part of San Francisco's comeback." Elizabeth Funk, CEO of homeless service provider dignity moves, told the Chronicle that the one shelter per district mandate in Mahmoud's original plan initially concerned her. Now she's happy to voice her support, especially for the provision that would allow homeless service providers to add shelter beds without the need for costly city review, just not in the neighborhoods, perhaps, where most of the homeless people are. Uh-huh. The most important thing he built into this is the flexibility, Funk said. Funk added that having homeless shelters outside downtown will increase the number of people who accept help. She may know more than I do. She's up there, and she's the head, the CEO, of Homeless Services, of Dignity Move, so maybe she does. It doesn't sound like that's necessarily true at all, that you're going to get more people who will accept help. It has to do with the quality of the shelters. It has to do with the acceptability. More important, it has to do whether they're really a road, as the navigation centers were supposed to be, from the street to real housing. Ha! Anyway, again, this is Aldo Toledo's story in the July 17, 2025 Chronicle. Proposal would spread out city shelters, liberally salted with my salty comments.
News coverage about the genocide has been mostly terrible in the West. It's been so biased in favor of Israel that in a recent poll, 50% of Americans weren't sure which side was losing more people in the fighting, despite Palestinian losses being almost incomparably worse. Despite the Zionist narrative being the dominant one across the Western press, whether we're talking about liberal press, conservative press, or objective press, the state of Israel and its appointed or self-appointed advocates in places like the United Kingdom and the United States has been in a constant state of overdrive, trying to keep pushing their extremely warped and inaccurate version of reality. The Zionist bot farms are all over the map in terms of effectiveness, however. The one that targeted me from February through May or so laid it on a bit thick, so that at least 98% of the comments I got on my Facebook page during those months consisted of the most disgusting lies and insults directed at me that generally contained within them different elements of the Hasbara pro-Zionist narrative. As the Israeli army is engaged in one after another documented case of torturing Palestinian women and men, raping Palestinian women and men, intentionally slaughtering entire extended families, or attacking hospitals with bunker-busting bombs, allegedly in order to assassinate one supposed member of Hamas, the Hasbara trolls and bots on Facebook inform us that those of us who are outraged at the genocide are ourselves supporting the genocide of Jews, and supporting the killing of Jewish babies, and so on. As the Israeli military is quite literally wiping Palestine off the map, and has been doing so for 76 years, the Hasbara bots inform us that it is we who are advocating for the end of the State of Israel, which of course many people are, since they are in favor of democracy and equality, not apartheid and theft. On the internet, they say it loud and clear, someone we might have been related to lived around here 2,000 years ago. Whatever happened since then doesn't matter. Look, there was a temple way back when, so it's all ours to bulldoze and remake the way we like. Anyone to disagree should have their heads up on a pike. That's what I learned from the Hasbara trolls. That's what I learned from the Hasbara trolls. On the internet, they say the Mufti said okay, so it makes good sense for us to take their land away. And besides, we tried to make peace so many times, but those ungrateful terrorists just want a bigger cut. Whatever has been offered, they always want some more. So now we're taking all of it, from the river to the shore. That's what I learned from the Hasbara trolls. That's what I learned from the Hasbara trolls. On the
internet, they say they've got made up history. We've rewritten all of it. Now Islam is the enemy. Don't mention the Crusades or the Inquisition or whatever else might get in the way of our revision. The Muslims are the bad ones. Now the Christians are our friends. If we're lying, that's okay. The means justify the ends. That's what I learned from the Hasbara trolls. That's what I learned from the Hasbara trolls. On the internet they say everything was fine. We're not sure why they keep talking about Palestine, which only ever existed in someone's imagination, just like all the history of this so-called nation, which is all just an illusion, a fantastic con, just like the existence of Egypt or Lebanon. That's what I learned from the Hasbara trolls. That's what I learned from the Hasbara trolls. On the internet they say, remember October 7th? It rhymes so neatly with September 11th. Crimes were committed and the terrorists fought back. Obviously they deserve everything they lack. This was our opportunity that fell into our lap to completely redraw the map. That's what I learned from the Hasbara trolls. That's what I learned from the Hasbara trolls. On the internet they say they don't like our state, even though we make their lives in it so great. They have towns, they have schools, they have democracy, as long as you don't count a few million refugees. They fire missiles at us. Who knows why? Our sensible conclusion is all their kids should die. That's what I learned from the Hasbara trolls. That's what I learned from the Hasbara trolls.
And back to the San Francisco Chronicle, the same day, July 17th, that I read you this, the prior story. Here's a front page story, SF toughens RV parking rules. By the same guy, Aldo Toledo, and a colleague, Tom Lai, or perhaps Lee. And it's got a photo of one fellow standing outside his RV, Devin Plant. He says the city's new policy will make more people homeless. And then there's another fellow, a San Francisco native, who lives in an RV near Lake Merced because he can't afford rent and wants to be self-sufficient. You see him inside his RV. The second headline is, City Approves Two-Hour Limits, New Permit Buyback Programs. And there's a quote from Mayor Daniel Lurie that's in large letters. Our families in San Francisco deserve better than the RV homelessness we've seen on our streets for years. Those in vehicles deserve better options for raising their kids, and those just trying to walk down the street deserve safety and cleanliness. These are frequently the pretext for police sweeps, and now the pretext for laws further justifying police sweeps against the people who actually have slightly one step up more decent places to live than those who are in tents or wrapped in blankets on the street. Let's hear how, I guess I should say it's good that the Chronicle is, it seems to be showing a more sympathetic view of this, of the RV folks, but of course they're a little closer to middle class people, so maybe it's an easier sell. In any case, here's maybe an easier sell to people who run their paper and who finance it. People living in RVs in San Francisco, the story begins, will soon be barred from parking longer than 2 hours on all city streets unless they get a permit, a move that critics say has caused significant distress among the hundreds of RV dwellers who live in the city. You might say, well, all they have to do is get a permit. I think it took Keith McHenry more than 100 visits until he finally got a permit, and then they removed the permit process in order to eliminate food not bombs. So I would wonder if their real objective is to eliminate RV parking in the city. That's what they're going to do, is find ways to do that. And this is simply one step toward that program. Continuing, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors this week gave initial approval to a law from Daniel Lurie, the mayor, or Daniel Lurie, that would impose strict two-hour parking limits for oversized vehicles to manage the hundreds of people living in vehicles on city streets. The board voted to approve the plan in a 9-2 vote, some dissenters, with supervisors Jackie Fielder and Shaman Walton voting no. Lurie introduced the legislation in June as a way to tackle the proliferation of vehicle dwellers in San Francisco. The combination of increased funding, enforcement, and outreach. Outreach means they will pay people to go out and say, gee, here's a list of numbers you can call if you want to cross your fingers and get some answering machines, and maybe a callback or two, who knows. For years, San Franciscans have seen people sleeping in vehicles and in RVs amid a dire housing affordability crisis, because people are trying to put something over their heads and around themselves to protect themselves. But that's not good enough for folks who are really more concerned with commerce and property values. That's my comment. Continuing, the mayor's plan will impose a two-hour parking limit for oversized vehicles on all city streets, with the exception of commercial vehicles parked in industrial areas. The word oversized tends to indicate this is what's used as the pretext. For me, this is what signals to me what they're doing is saying, see, this is these big vehicles that block everyone's view and are a traffic hazard and are unsightly and all kinds of other things, but they're oversized, see. That's the issue. But there's no mention in this story of what the oversizing is. In Santa Cruz, I think it's 20 feet, and they've only banned it at night. In the city under, I think the hours, 2 to 6, something like that. Maybe after midnight, I'm confessed to being not as up as I need to be on RV specifics in Santa Cruz. Somebody call me at 423-4833 and give me some more information about that. And I will mention it in the next broadcast. Supervisor Myrna Melgar, who sponsored the legislation on behalf of the mayor, said the legislation also includes several additions made during negotiations with other supervisors and the mayor. The law will include a refuge permit system, which allows people living in vehicles to apply for a renewable 6-month permit contingent on compliance with community rules around such things as waste disposal and neighborhood behavior, a neighborly behavior, as well as outgoing work with housing support services. In other words, sign on to our registration system, number one. And then also, maybe it's better than Santa Cruz. I would hope so, because Santa Cruz requires you have a connection with somebody who has property in the area, you can park in front of their house while you're visiting them in your RV. Or, of course, if you're a commercial vehicle. People living in RVs will also have access to a buyback program that will provide financial support for those willing to relinquish their vehicles in exchange for aid towards securing permanent housing. Notice it's not in exchange for permanent housing. It's aid toward securing permanent housing. Both programs will allow the city to track RV dwellers in order to better provide them with services, or else keep their eye on them, perhaps, and maybe provide them with citations. Melgar said, he didn't say that, that's what I say. He said services. In a city as wealthy as ours, I think it's on us to build a system to support people to success and not pretend that by leaving them to be out on the streets, we are doing the progressive thing, Melgar said. Well, you're doing the progressive thing if the alternative is to go after them with the police. Then by not going after with the police, you're at least being progressive in that way, leaving them alone, letting them try to get together and find their own way. The board's approval on Tuesday highlights how the alliance between a, quote, moderate majority on the Board of Supervisors, I would call it a right-wing majority, and the mayor's office has significantly changed City Hall politics. Just last year, Mayor London Breed was blocked from making minor changes to the city's parking rules by a progressive Board of Supervisors that often clashed with her. Indeed, how the new normal shifts in the cruel direction as more people get to watch the Gaza bombing and turn back to their video games, or whatever else they're doing, whatever else we're doing, I should say. Now, a year later, Lurie has a moderate board working with him to push his agenda, having already passed laws to address the city's fentanyl crisis and permitting issues. Melger said Lurie's legislation is great progress over what was proposed by Breed. The new policy is expected to go into effect this fall. Lurie said in a statement he was proud to join the board in passing, quote, a plan that will finally give all our families what they deserve. It just sounds like so much horseshit to me. Our families in San Francisco deserve better than the RV homelessness we've seen on our streets for years. I just can't stand to see a hungry face when I'm eating a nice warm meal. Or perhaps when I'm eating a meal that's not so nice, but worrying I'm going to have to be reminded that I may have to be in an RV in 6 months once the landlord raises the rent. Those in vehicles, Lurie continues, the mayor says, deserve better options for raising their kids, and those just trying to walk down the streets deserve safety and cleanliness. Who can dispute such a statement? But of course, it's like most of the things Trump says. It doesn't bear any relation to the facts, and it's said simply to pander to a certain constituency, is my suspicion. Despite her reservations about the plan, the story continues, Supervisor Connie Chan said she ultimately supported it because the mayor showed he is working in good faith to get RV dwellers housed and not just taking punitive action against them. Well, maybe she knows something that I don't catch from this story. San Francisco voters want us to deliver solutions with public dollars, and our city's most vulnerable cannot wait for the perfect policy, Chan said. Mayor Lurie and his team, and especially Supervisor Melgar, have demonstrated in good faith that they have a thoughtful approach and compassionate solutions. And she's using her thesaurus and her dictionary very well here, saying using the right words, or maybe she's being very optimistic about her conversations with Mayor Lurie. But Walton was sharp in his criticism of the mayor's legislation. Walton, I think, was one of the two who voted against this. Walton said the proposal offering housing to people living in RVs as the city deals with the shortage of housing, that the proposal is offering housing. More RVs than shelter builds equals an ineffective and impossible plan, a plan to fail, Walton said. This would be an attack on people trying to have a shelter in this expensive city, and they would lose their only homes. For those living in RVs, the prospect of having nowhere to park legally has been stressful. During a walk near Lake Merced on Tuesday, San Francisco native Bill Russo told the Chronicle he lives in an RV because he wanted to be completely self-sufficient. Because he has secured a disabled person license plate, Russo has only to move his RV for street cleaning every 2 weeks, as opposed to every 4 hours, as required of other RVs in the area. But Russo says he will be subject to the new restriction and will likely receive a temporary special permit allowing him to park in the city for only 6 more months. I'm counting on the delays and the fact that this won't be executed, Russo said. Meanwhile, Devin Plant, a nearby RV dweller who said he has been parked in the city for just over a month, is mainly worried about what will happen to community members who don't have a way out. RV dwellers are going to deal with harsher conditions, Plant said, and will end up under a bridge. People don't understand that this is what happens. Plant plans to leave the city this week for a guest Service's job is lined up in Yosemite National Park. And that, again, is front page story in the July 17, 2025 Chronicle. SF toughens RV parking rules by Aldo Toledo and Tom Li, or Lee, or L-I, however that is pronounced.
In the spring of 2024, protests on college campuses across the U.S. escalated and became commonplace. The biggest and most active encampments, from what I gathered, were on campuses with large Jewish populations. A very large number of the world's Jews are Americans, and many of them still live in the region where their ancestors first landed at Ellis Island, which for most of them slash us occurred sometime between 3 and 6 generations ago. Also, many of the most elite universities in the U.S. are located in the Northeast. Many Jews or people of Jewish background in the U.S. support Israel as rabidly and unquestioningly as Biden does, no doubt about that. But many view Israel as an apartheid state that is currently waging genocidal wars against the entire Palestinian population and now Lebanon as well. In any case, the campus protests were widespread and included many participants of all kinds of different backgrounds, and the repression against them from campus authorities and police was brutal and anti-democratic.
It's happening now, like it has before, at the universities, in a time of war. Put people together, they'll communicate, talk about things like college and state, talk about the research that built the Iron Dome, talk about their relatives starving back at home, talk about tuition and where the money's spent, and where all the buildings in Gaza went. Wake up each morning and the headlines say how many hundreds of Palestinians died today, how many thousands were killed in the past week. People get together, people speak. The newscasters say with surety the campuses lack security. Meanwhile, across the ocean wide, Palestinian genocide. People are saying they won't leave till they win, and then the police are sent in. Beaten and arrested staff and students to try to silence this growing movement. They're punishing people for making it known that the direct connection can be easily shown. How the investments of this institution are funding another final solution. Where goes this anyone's guess? After all, this is the U.S. Battles have been lost and won, but with bombs being dropped every day by the ton, with the orphaned and famished beneath the sky, waiting for the moment when it's their turn to die. So people just can't look away. They have to set up a tent on the campus and say, boycott, sanction, and divest. 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 Boycott, sanction, and divest.
And next, briefly, we're going to turn to this. Well, the last Huff meeting on the Thursday of the 17th, where we had a small but interested group of individuals talking about various updates with sweeps and so-called street cleaning expeditions going after RVs in Santa Cruz, and also possibly the activists going after, or potential activists anyway, going after information that could be useful in encouraging the community to understand just what's going on in terms of public money being spent to sweep away people, seize their tents, to destroy their property, and then do the same thing again the next week when they come back to the same place, or to fence off the area and to have them go to another place and do the same thing. One of the principal places this happens is at Coral Street. And so that's an area that's because that's the location of the Funding Matters Poverty Complex, as I call it, the $4 million services, the new buildings that are going up, but the meals still aren't open to members of the homeless community unless they're on the particular program so that they can be, I presume, so they can be used to get money from other sources. Whereas I remember a time not terribly long ago, prior to 2015 or 2016, when the Housing Matters, as they call themselves, as I say, Funding Matters, was actually providing meals to anyone who came. Since that time, they've become much more repressive, gated a community there, and they've even commended the police for the police sweeps where the homeless folks have placed tents outside Housing Matters waiting to get in, often unsuccessfully, or just to have a place to park their asses, so to speak, to lay down and sleep. This isn't particularly good publicity for 115 Coral Street, the Funding Matters group, so they appreciate it, or at least Phil Kramer, the head of this group, commended the police for what they were doing, which is to say destroying homeless property, driving people away from one area after another. And of course, I suppose in a way this might encourage people to join Housing Matters, but since they don't have the facilities anyway for the people to do this, is as was stated in San Francisco with destroying its RVs, premature, destroying the RV places that people can go to park and making it a crime to park in an RV without a permit in San Francisco. As it's also a crime in Santa Cruz to park a vehicle over 20 feet long without a permit at night, which means you have to move your vehicle all the time. For people who are poor, that's kind of hard to do, particularly with expensive older vehicles, which actually are serving as makeshift shelters. Here's a part of the Huff meeting where there is a discussion. I guess Athena kind of leads the discussion. You'll hear the voices of Athena, Gloria, me, possibly Laura, talking about the issue of potentially a protest that gathers information and encourages authorities to realize they are being scrutinized, that they can't continue their evil ways without the pitiless glare of publicity, what little publicity we can provoke. Athena talks about some of the rules for driving away RVs in Santa Cruz by using street sweeping cleaning operations, and a little bit about that. Yeah, so here that is.
When we drove by, it was there were no tents. Mm-hmm. And there had been tents yesterday.
This is in Coral.
I think you were telling me there were. Yeah. I didn't see it. I wasn't looking. You were.
I'm always, peeking over there to see what's going on. And so they may be doing a Thursday.
I'm surprised they didn't combine Coral Street in front of Housing Matters sweeps with the car sleeper sweeps that are on Coral, Delaware, etc. Those are on Wednesdays and Fridays, but I haven't seen them like collate.
Now, what is on Wednesdays and Fridays?
On Wednesdays and Fridays at 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. is the sweep, street sweeping. You can get ticketed if you're on the wrong side of the road.
Which would be where?
Wednesdays and Fridays are on Coral Street, Delaware, and Lime Kiln or something. Thursdays and Tuesdays are, Delaware is on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Tuesdays and Thursdays is Delaware and streets next to Delaware. Wednesdays and Fridays is Pearl Street, Harvey West, and those kinds of streets, as well as Ocean Street gets swept on the same day Coral Street gets swept.
Cleaned, right?
Cleaned, but you can get ticketed. And it's also called swept, which sucks.
Yeah.
Because that's how the city calls it. It's a street sweeping or something like that.
Coral, Lime, Kiln, and Fern Streets then on Wednesday and Thursday?
Friday. Tuesday and Thursday is Delaware. Wednesday, Friday is Coral and Ocean.
Gotcha.
And then their surrounding streets.
And the levee is anytime.
And levee's anytime.
Okay.
But those sweeps about the cars have not been the same. They haven't been a, and the police come and sweep the people. It's been just a ticketing and cleaners.
Those machines, the sweep.
I think
sweep,
so.
Sweeper thing.
Believe it or not, I've slept through every time that I was like, oh, I should wake up and see what happens at 5 a.m.
Probably not them. If I, you know, it's those street sweepers, if you've ever seen them, they just go,
yeah,
and they're done.
Yeah,
you know,
it's very fast. The issue is that you can get ticketed, that you can get towed.
Yeah, right. If your car's in the wrong place,
the wrong side.
And everybody gets ticketed or towed. I mean, it's not just so. Yeah.
Yeah, but I haven't seen them combining.
It's not yet. That's
been true since January. That's when that pilot program, like, officially started.
Of actually sweeping the street.
Of the new signs and the scheduled street sweeping. They had street sweepers, and they did it sometimes, but then they did, like, a pilot program last year where they only did it sometimes, and then now they're doing it, supposedly, every Wednesday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
You know that some of the people, like the, you know, executives at Housing Matters, you know,
Real Estate Matters.
She,
I like them both.
She, she said that the street smelled like urine. And to be honest,
that's crazy. You put out a porta potty.
Well, I haven't.
Put out two porta potties.
I walk down there and hand out donuts and sandwiches and. I haven't noticed. I mean, I don't have the strongest sense of a smell, but I can usually smell urine.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't smelled it. But, you know, if somebody is complaining about urine smell, this cleaning the streets, that makes sense. So this would be a good thing, except that apparently, you know, anybody that has a tent there, well, you can't, they have to move it on those days, right?
I don't know.
Because there's tents all the way up and down Coral Street.
Yeah, but people can't park on that street, so I think they just don't do that section those days. Because there isn't actually... There's like a punishment system for the cars, and there's a punishment system for the tents, and they're not on the same days.
Okay, but the tents are not... Maybe they're on the sidewalk?
Exactly.
So they do this street cleaning.
And they don't have to bother the tent people to do it.
I see.
They only bother the car people to do those sweeps.
Mm.
And then there's tent sweeps where it's very easy to get out of when you're in a car. You just move.
Right. But
and it's only a punishment for tent sleepers.
Yeah. And then do they clean underneath where the tents were?
Barely. Depends, but barely.
They just basically move people.
Yeah. It's shockingly dirty.
And I think it was Athena's analysis of tent sweeps was that they happen every Monday, although I've also heard it said it was done on Tuesday as well. So, God knows. Here's more.
On the streets, right after a sweep. Because they made everybody move in a hurry, making it so there's just, like, trash... and, like, ripped apart things. And then also, like, police have been known to, like, cut apart things or destroy items. And so it takes a while for the public works guys to throw everything in the truck. So it's, like, a real big mess for a while. And when the public works leaves and the police leave, you'd think that the street would be clean, but it just isn't ever clean after they leave. They never actually pick up all of the trash. And with the Poganip sweeps, it is pitiful. They don't clean at all.
Oh,
they
yeah,
just move
that.
People.
Yeah.
And then they...
Well, last year they had big plastic bags full of garbage. that they left there for, it was months.
Months.
It was at least months. 6 months that those garbage bags were left in the Pocono.
Yeah.
We kept, every time we walked up there, we, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, I do.
Big pile of garbage bags.
Yep.
Any thoughts, Thomas?
Well, I'm just thinking about two Mondays ago, at least, I was parked on Delaware one night, and something like 5 or 6 in the morning, I thought I heard a prowler around my car, but I didn't get up to look out over my window screens.
Right.
And then later on, not even till later in that day, like afternoon, evening, I was on my way to get something to eat, and I noticed a ticket flapping on my windshield.
Mm. How much?
It was $0.
Oh, it was a warning.
It was like serving as a warning that you can't park there on Tuesday mornings 5 to 7 for street cleaning.
Yep.
So I thought, well, that's fair enough, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe because that was only the first time they ever saw my vehicle there.
Mm-hmm. And where was this, Delaware?
Delaware.
I'm glad to hear you got a zero. The articles coming out when they start the program promised that people would get zeros and warnings first.
Yeah.
And I hadn't heard of anybody that got a warning, so I'm glad to hear you.
Yeah, when I saw the ticket flapping, I go, oh, shit, mm-hmm. Look at this. And then I get out and look, and it just says $0 on the fine, but it said about the street.
And so you moved?
Well, I just... I had moved already early Tuesday morning, but not till like 10 o'clock. But then I just don't park there on Monday nights anymore.
Yeah, totally.
Because I'm not going to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and move. I'm not even going to wait there.
Luckily it is, it's one side on a day and then the other side a different day.
Mm-hmm.
So you can sleep in the same area every night. You just have to be sure you're on the right side of the road.
Yeah.
Rather than like Tuesdays and Thursdays, you just can't sleep on Delaware at all.
Yeah.
I'm glad that it's one side at a time, but it still sucks.
You know, what you're describing goes on all over the country.
Yeah.
I mean, for years, it's always been like that.
Yeah, it's just a new schedule.
Yeah. It's just for Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't doing it.
Any other street reports?
And that's the kind of dialogue you'll be finding if you wander into the Huff meeting, sometimes somewhat more chaotic, tumultuous, and one voice over another, sometimes me insisting on the agenda, and other times looser and folks breaking off into small groups and chatting. That's every Thursday, as long as we continue it, from 1:30 to 3:30 at the Sub Rosa Cafe at 703 Pacific. So be advised. You can also then go next door and get your bike fixed or volunteer to help. I think Tenant Sanctuary may even be over there too. Fabrica is another group that's at the Center for Sustainable... Boy, not sure I even know the name of that 703 complex, but it's got various sort of countercultural or community help groups. But here's a little Rovix. We're getting close to closing out the contemporary part of the show. So here's Rovix to remind us of what's really going on, where people are getting blown away and... children are dying.
At the end of August 2024, Sarah Wilkinson was arrested from her home in England by a large group of masked, heavily armed, At the end of August 2024, Sarah Wilkinson was arrested from her home in England by a large group of masked, heavily armed men who claimed to be some kind of police. She was one of many journalists and social media influencers to be arrested in England in recent times for the same supposed crime of posting something online that was deemed to break British law because it was supposedly praising a proscribed organization such as Hamas. Sarah was banged around in the back of a police wagon a la Freddie Gray, prevented from accessing her much-needed medical prescriptions for ongoing serious health conditions, and eventually allowed to go back home. She was then held in a sort of house arrest situation, before the pressure coming from various corners in Sarah's support caused the authorities at least to drop her impossible bail conditions. What happens next with the Crown's charges against her and others
on the streets will
eventually
of London.
Find out.
You just never know who might come knocking at your door in the early glow as the sun is rising and you're in the embrace of unidentified thugs with balaclavas on their faces ransacking your house and looting all your things. You never know what kind of terror the day brings on the streets of London. You could get arrested anytime, having hurt no one by committing any crime, with handcuffs on your wrists until your fingers turn blue, deprived of medication that you need in order to make it through the day without ending up dead. But if you died, that would be fine. That's what the cops said on the streets of London. They don't need to show ID. Could be criminals or agents from some other country. They say they don't need a warrant. They can just invade and do whatever they want in their counter-terror raid. They can dump your mother's ashes all over the floor, put you in a cell and make sure you know the score on the streets of London. If you think you're free to post about the genocide that's happening on the Mediterranean coast, they may hold you without trial, under house arrest, and in this citadel of democracy, the mother of the West, they're silencing celebrities and those who would speak out against the horrors that they're trying to tell us all about on the streets of London. Whether you obey determines whether you have the freedom to say anything that's critical of the military men's selling off. You have the freedom to say anything that's critical of the military men's selling all the bombs that are killing all the children. Post about such things and you may hear the judge sentence you to 14 years on the streets of London. On the streets of London. On the streets of London.
And here's the last story from the July 18th issue of the Mercury News. It's on the back page, more or less. Back pages. Justice Department wants no prison time for ex-officer convicted in Breonna Taylor raid, Louisville, Kentucky, by Dylan Lovin, AP. The U.S. Justice Department is recommending an ex-Kentucky police officer convicted of using excessive force during the deadly Breonna Taylor raid should serve no prison time, an abrupt about-face after spending years prosecuting the former detective. Brett Hankison is the only officer who fired his weapon the night of March 2020, when there was a botched drug raid, who has faced criminal charges. His shots didn't hit or injure anyone, though they flew through Taylor's walls into a neighboring apartment. A federal judge will decide Hankinson's sentence, which could amount to several years, on Monday at a hearing. But if the judge heeds the Justice Department's request, it would mean that none of the Louisville police officers involved in the botched raid would face any prison time. The Justice Department, which has changed leadership under President Donald Trump since Hankison's conviction, said in a sentencing memo this week that there is no need for a prison sentence to protect the public from Hankison. Mm-hmm. Federal prosecutors asked the judge to sentence him to time already served, which amounts to one day, and 3 years of supervised probation. Prosecutors at his previous federal trials aggressively pursued a conviction against Hankison, 49, arguing that he blindly fired 10 shots into Taylor's windows without identifying a target. Taylor was shot in her hallway by two other officers after her boyfriend fired from inside the apartment, striking an officer in the leg. But in the sentencing memo, federal prosecutors wrote that Hankison's response in these fraught circumstances was unreasonable given the benefit of hindsight that That unreasonable response did not kill or wound Breonna Taylor, her boyfriend, her neighbors, defendants, fellow officers, or anyone else. Activists who protested in the streets after Taylor's death in 2020 seized on the narrative that under the Department of Justice recommendation, Hankison would serve just one day in jail for the conviction. Here's a longer story from the New York Times. Justice Department asks for one day's sentence for ex-officer convicted in Breonna Taylor raid. I'm skipping a bit of it, which repeats the earlier AP story. This is by Glenn Thrush. The chief of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Unit has asked a federal judge to sentence a Louisville peace officer convicted in the 2020 killing of Breonna Taylor to one day in prison. Last year, a federal jury in Kentucky convicted Brett Hankison, the officer, of one count of violating Ms. Taylor's civil rights by using excessive force in discharging several shots through her window during a drug raid that went awry. He faces a maximum sentence of life in prison, and a judge will consider the government's request at a sentencing scheduled for next week. I guess it hasn't happened yet. On Wednesday, Harsmet K. Dillon, the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, asked the judge in the case, Rebecca Grady Jennings, to sentence Mr. Hankison to one day in prison, essentially the brief time he had served when he was charged, and 3 years of, mentioned before, supervised release. In the filing, Ms. Dillon suggested the prosecution was excessive, arguing that the Biden Justice Department had secured a conviction against Mr. Hankison after his acquittal on state charges and the ending of his first federal trial in a mistrial. In this case, two federal trials were ultimately necessary to obtain a unanimous verdict of guilt, Ms. Dillon wrote, adding that Mr. Hankison, now a felon who was fired from his job 5 years ago, has already paid a substantial penalty for his actions. The jury's verdict will almost certainly ensure that defendant Hankison never serves as a law enforcement again and will also ensure that he never legally possesses a firearm again. I guess they'll have to use a rap or something to deal with those he feels are criminal in nature. That's my sarcastic comment. Such requests are typically filed by career prosecutors who worked on the case. Wednesday's filing was signed by Ms. Dillon, a political appointee who is a veteran Republican Party activist with close ties to Fuhrer Trump. New York Times calls him President Trump, and one of her deputies. Shortly after the department made its request public, the family's legal team issued a statement describing Ms. Taylor's mother, Tamika Palmer, as, quote, heartbroken and angry. The family asked for one thing, that Brett Hankison be sentenced in accordance with the law and the federal guidelines, the lawyers wrote, adding, recommending just one day in prison sends the unmistakable message that white officers can violate civil rights of black Americans with near total impunity. Samantha Treppel, a former attorney with the Civil Rights Division, urged the judge to ignore the recommendations, calling the filing transparent last-minute political interference. Mr. Hankison, who is white, was the only officer to be charged for his actions during the botched operation that prompted protests across the country. And we've read this section before from the earlier story. Apparently, the AP got it from the New York Times. The killing brought national attention to no-knock warrants. A judge initially signed off on such a warrant for Ms. Taylor's apartment, but officers were later instructed to announce themselves. Whether they complied remains an unresolved issue. The chief of the Louisville Metro Police Department was fired in the wake of protests of the killing, and a report by the Justice Department 2 years ago found that the department had shown a pattern of discriminating against black people. Hundreds of lawyers and other staff members have left the Civil Rights Division, with veterans of the office saying that they were driven out by Trump administration officials who want to aggressively pursue cases against the Ivy League, other schools, and liberal cities. Lawyers in the division traditionally saw their work as protecting the constitutional rights of minority communities and marginalized people. Shortly after Mr. Trump was sworn in for his second term, his political appointees of the Justice Department ordered an immediate halt to all new civil rights cases or investigations, and signaled that it might back out of a Biden-era agreement with police departments that engaged in discrimination or violence, several agreements apparently, according to two internal memos sent to staff. The actions, while expected, represented an abrupt about-face for the department that had in the past 4 years aggressively investigated high-profile instances of violence and systematic discrimination in local law enforcement and governmental agencies. The first of two memos sent by Chad Mizell, the chief of staff of the department, ordered a, quote, litigation freeze at the Civil Rights Division to determine whether Trump appointees want, quote, to initiate any new cases, according to a screenshot of the document viewed by the New York Times. A second memo ordered a similar freeze on department activity involving so-called consent decrees, agreements hashed out with local governments intended to address flawed police practices or bias based on race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, and disabilities. In May, Ms. Dillon announced she was backing out of Biden-era agreements with Louisville and Minneapolis that were intended to enact policing reforms in the wake of the Taylor killing and the murder of George Floyd, calling them overbroad and bureaucratic. The moves were part of a larger effort, spearheaded by Ms. Dillon and backed by senior White House officials, to prioritize enforcement of Führer Trump's culture war edicts, including participation of transgender women in sports, over the division's founding purpose of fighting race-based discrimination. In an email in April, Ms. Dillon directed the division's career workforce to pursue the Führer's agenda. I am, of course, describing the actual behavior of Trump, not just the fact that he is the president. Outlined in executive orders and presidential memorandums, or face unspecified consequences. The revised statement encouraged investigations into anti-Semitism, anti-Christian bias, and non-compliance with a range of Trump executive fiats. The zealous and faithful pursuit of this section's mission requires the full dedication of this section's resources, attention, and energy in the priorities of the president, she wrote. In a separate mission statement sent to the division's voting rights unit, Ms. Dillon directed department lawyers to root out voter fraud and prosecute undocumented immigrants who tried to vote in U.S. elections. Both are rare events, despite efforts by Trump Republicans, including Ms. Dillon, to portray them as a major threat to election integrity. And that's a story by Glenn Thrush in the New York Times of the 17th. Justice Department asked for one-day sentence for ex-officer convicted in Breonna Taylor raid. And comes now an October 23rd flashback to 2003. And we get to hear about former council member Scott Kennedy's progressive past. I give you all my critical comments about that. And this was when he was still alive. He died about a decade later after continuing his was he reelected after that? I think he was, actually. But I'm not sure. I know we were able to oust him in 2004. And you get to hear David Silva, who also has died. He talks about his work on putting an initiative on the ballot and then getting assaulted by the police at city council for trying to deliver the, I guess it was the signed petitions to the city clerk at the city council meeting. This was in the midst of a protest that was called the Lockdown Chain Gang Protest, or that's anyway what I call it. Silva claims ended his candidacy in 1996 when the assault happened for the city council. and he regarded it as a political assault on him, involving also we also get some discussion of the rent control debate. And there was also a National Police Brutality Day on the 22nd of October, though I believe Santa Cruz had its own local Anti-Police Brutality Day on October 18th of that year. Let me make a correction to the date of this flashback. It isn't 2003. I'm jumping back to a flashing back to a prior flashback. This was 1997. It's about, six or seven years, 8 years before, actually. However, here's more of what happened. Here, what you're going to be hearing if you listen to this. There was a discussion of a youth curfew that was happening, coming to the Public Safety Committee meeting, which was canceled, of which Council Member Scott Kennedy was a member. And you're also going to hear Skidmark Bob discussing his panhandling ticket. And as a troubadour on the streets, Bob, who's now, I think, an employee of the Parks and Rec and is kind of on the other side of the fence, talks about his first ever panhandling ticket. I think he got a ticket later for terrorist threats, or maybe it was a few years before 1997. I think he had a song, Shoplifting at the Bookshop Santa Cruz. There were numerous counterculture songs that talked about specific political abuses and targeted particular individuals, organizations, and businesses that were abusive of homeless and poor people, either through their city council actions or their private business policies. Go to Eureka and the South Spit Jetty, which I mentioned briefly at the beginning of this this whole broadcast, which evicted a whole bunch of people who had done a settlement with the city to go camp on the South Spit Jetty as a survival campground. And then they were run off under a phony health pretext by a health officer. I guess Ann Lindsay was her name. It may have been Lindsay, actually, was the health officer who was defending the folks on the jetty. And certainly Jan Turner, the Legal Assistance Foundation attorney, was involved with that. I'm not sure you're going to have to listen to it to pick up the details. You'll get to hear Father Eric Duff, and then you'll hear Julia Vinograd, who's a Berkeley poet, reading from her, it's an audio tape of hers, Eye of the Hand. And next, pepper spray police abuse at Berkeley City Council being discussed at an October 21st, 1997 hearing. And finally, we skip back not to totally diss poor Scott Kennedy, his support, actually, of homeless people in opposing making the town clock a designated park closed after certain hours, which was done in order to drive away a 24-hour protest against police violence that was going on there. And you get to hear the city council's discussion of that issue and some of the testimony, pro and con. And that's it for the Bathrop Spears Broadsides flashback to October 23rd, am I right on that? Yeah, 1997, as well as, of course, the show for today's July 20th, 2025. So, enjoy it. Learn from it if you can. Remember that community participation is needed now more than ever. If you see stuff happening on the street, stop and whip out your cell phone or a video device and look at it and put it up online with a commentary at good police work or very shitty police work. Homeless criminals being captured or homeless people being harassed. Document. Because there are no government agencies that are going to do this for you these days. It has to be the community that does. If you got anything you want to report that you think is relevant to this show, either things you object to that you've heard or things you might want to say that weren't included, call me at 423-4833. That's the Huff line, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, 423-4833. And you can also call a line to report homeless abuses at 216-8239. 216-8239. And that's it for now. Take care. Bye-bye.